I have this book called, like, an anthology of the best music writing from 2006. Uh-huh. And one of them is a review of this album by a group called Frosty. The name of the album is Liquor Drink. And it's, like, one of the funniest reviews. It's just, like, I don't know who would listen to this. I don't know who. Like, it's totally, like, you know, it's screaming, basically.
Well, you've actually joined us mid-conversation for the Indie Opera Podcast. And we're talking about reviews, and that's actually something I wanted to bring up.
Reviews?
Well, I think we should do reviews at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it should be official that we're attending to do a review.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? So if anyone wants us to review your show, contact us, send us 2 tickets, and we will go and review your show. Now, I just want to say...
We'll come with a little golf pencil and monocles.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That it's going to be completely opinionated and from a musician's perspective. I'm a conductor, and Noah's a musicologist / singer / teacher.
Yeah.
Right. So it won't be a regular sort of review. And you know how they usually, I think, reviews are useless.
Yeah, a little bit, because they're like, they pretend that they're this view from nowhere, right?
Yeah, and as a performer, I want to know... Gee, I don't want to know that the book came from 1840. I want to know, did this piece work?
Right.
So if you get us tickets,
I don't know. If someone's giving me an opinion, I feel like I get more from that than if I get some sort of pretend objective thing.
Right. You know? No. We're going to be completely opinionated.
Like the other day, somebody was talking about trying to find an unbiased news source and stuff, and it's like, just get a biased one, and then pick. You know, I don't know.
You know where it's coming from.
Yeah, that's right.
So, if you want us to review your show, send us some tickets.
Yeah.
All right.
Free tickets.
So, on this Indie Opera Podcast...
We speak to Misha Penton, Artistic Director of Divergence Vocal Theater, about their new project, Clytemnestra, which premieres April 15th and 16th in Houston.
Also on today's podcast... We will have a discussion with Robert J. I just lost his name.
Bradshaw.
Thank you. Robert J. Bradshaw, composer of Dot Gabriel.
And I spoke with composer Hannah Lash, who is premiering a work in the upcoming Vox Festival, and the opera's called Blood Rose. Hannah and I went to school at Eastman together. We actually played in the Gamelan together.
Really?
Yeah, that was...
I love Gamelan.
Yeah, that was... Oh, man, that's something I really miss. I know I could probably find a group in New York, but
yeah.
I just don't have time right now. But I loved playing in the Gamelan. And and she's really smart and well-spoken, and it's a really good interview. She does most of the talking. That's why it's really good.
We got a lot of great feedback. My dad gave us feedback.
Yeah.
He said that we sound like the guys on Car Talk.
That's okay. That's good.
Yeah, I mean, he meant it as a compliment to us.
Yeah.
And not an insult to them.
Yeah.
No, they could...
Well, I love the guys on Car Talk.
I know, but I don't want them... I don't think we're that fabulous yet.
No, of course not. They're established, raconteurs. Or
and we also got some constructive feedback from one listener who said that they want us to be funnier and smarter.
Funnier and smarter.
Basically.
Well, we're going to work on it.
It's one of my goals.
I'm always trying to be funnier and smart.
And let's see, what else do we hear about? I heard from Twyla Emke in San Francisco, who has started an opera company out there.
Mm-hmm.
So Twyla, you're starting an opera company?
Yes, the San Francisco Bay Opera Company.
Okay, tell
and
me about it.
I was astounded that name was available out here. And I've connected with... an old friend out here who I sang in Hamburg in Phantom of the Opera, and she's been living in the Bay Area for 20 years.
You were in Phantom?
Yeah, in Hamburg.
You toured there, or are you...
No, it wasn't
spot?
A tour. It was one theater, 2 years.
In English?
In German.
Yeah.
Wirklich, Monsieur, ich habe eine Nachricht vom Oben Geist.
I would love to have seen that. Oh my gosh.
It was really well done, and the theater was better built than the one that on Broadway.
Really?
I mean, when that when that chandelier came crashing down, you were really scared.
As far as the new opera company, what do you see? Where do you see it going?
Out here in the Bay Area, there is a vast market of singers who have no place to sing, because I discovered in the 3 years that I've been out here that most of the mainstream companies, they want only people that are coming straight out of conservatory, straight out of university, and ages in their 20s, they want to stop at 35 and not give opportunity to anyone over 35 to do any performing on stage, unless, of course, you've already made your name somewhere else. There are Marilla graduates out here that have no place to sing. Right. Because they're over 35. Well, I'm giving them that opportunity.
Is the climate experimental, or are they very conservative? What do people do out there?
At Berkeley, they do experimental things, but sometimes they take traditional things and work experimentally with a traditional opera. For instance, I saw a really cute production last, it's almost a year ago now, of Don Giovanni. And the guy used, in one scene, it was the best thing, he used an iPhone. And when Leporello's doing his aria, they're scrolling through. It was really, really well done. And then they pulled up the map and they had all the pins on all. It was very, very clever. Very clever. There is new composers out here. Of course, you know Rick Hagee.
Yeah.
Lives here in San Francisco. And
what sort of things do you want to do?
We're doing a concert in June of trios. We're doing the Rosenkavalier Trio. We're doing the duets from Rosenkavalier. We're doing Bellini, Norma. The crowd-pleasing things. The things that are going to pull the audience in and get them interested. In 2 years or so, we can start expanding and including experimental things. I want to enroll Hagee and other composers in the area and, you know, canvas them and get them involved. I mean, Frederica von Stade is living over in Alameda, and she's in her 60s. Her voice is in wonderful shape.
Well, maybe she's listening to the podcast.
Oh, wouldn't that be great?
Just email us, and I'll get you in contact with Twyla.
But it's a new concept. My friend Susan calls them the veterans, and I say I don't like to use that word because you say veteran and people think of war.
Well, it sort of is.
yeah, it sort of is. However, these are for the singers who are experienced. Their voices are very much intact. Their technique is superb, and to give them an opportunity to go out and show an audience what adults can do.
It's adult entertainment. Try and raise money using that title. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, there's a lot of weird people on the internet. It's opera for adults. Anyway, I don't want to let you go before we talk a little bit about the program with San Francisco Renaissance Voices. Now, this is an early music group,
right.
And I've really enjoyed the professionalism and the sound that this group is able to do. And they are going and putting on a benefit for the Japan tragedy. And those people need as much help as they can get. My heart just goes out to them. We have to do something to help these people. And this is one way that we can help.
Great. And if people want to get more information about your opera company, where do they need to go?
They can write me at sfbayoperaco@gmail.com and I'll put them on the list, and so when we're up and running, I can send out a little message and they all can log on.
Great. And I'll also post on our website the address for the Japan fundraiser as
right.
well, and people can click there and see a great concert.
Yeah. Or if they can't make the concert for whatever reason, they can still donate. They can buy a ticket, and it will be and the money will go to the Japan effort.
Great.
You have to come out here.
I want to come out there. I'll come out there. Invite me. I'll conduct.
We'll talk about that at another time.
Cool.
Okay.
Ciao.
Take care. Ciao, bye. Ciao.
And the other thing we heard about was there's a company who is doing the coronation of Poppaea in Amsterdam, and they're collaborating with a hip-hop dance company.
Wow.
Called ISH, and the name of the vocal company is Vocal Lab. And they're going to...
See, that sounds like it would work.
Yeah.
You know, because it's Coronation of Poppaea is such an early opera.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of enough. It's a little bit... It works. And it seems like... Because there's such disparate elements. They could come together.
Yeah. They're doing some previews in the next few weeks. They're going to send us some sound files. And we'll put that on our website as well. Mm-hmm. The other thing I was told about was the Tin Angel, which is the Center for Contemporary Opera is doing. It was written at the McDowell Colony in my hometown, Peterborough, New Hampshire.
Peterborough.
And... Let's see, what else? What else do people let us know about? Oh, yeah.
So much new opera.
Yeah, there's a lot. I was surprised at how much is going on and how much I didn't know.
Yeah.
There's an opera about Clarence and Anita.
Written Clarence Thomas? The Supreme Court?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Written by Ben Yarmolinsky, who I really, really love his work. I've heard his songs, which are hysterical.
Yeah.
And he's doing that with the Underworld Productions Opera, and there's some previews coming up. There's one on April 13th at Manhattan College.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the middle of the day at 4 p.m.
Oh, which, that's right up the block.
Yeah. Huh. Now, I can't make
that's
it.
That's where my sister goes. I can make it if it's at, yeah.
Yeah?
I can make it.
They're going to record some so we can get some on the show. Eventually, it'll actually premiere, I think, in June 8th and 9th, he said. So, we've got that to look forward to.
Excellent.
Over here and listen to me. Please, Gabriel. Please, Gabriel.
We have Robert J. Bradshaw here, the composer of Dot Gabriel. Hey, Robert, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you today?
Great. So, I've listened to Dot Gabriel. Actually, the first time I listened to it, I just put it in the background to get sort of an idea of the acoustic sound of the piece. I didn't listen to it very carefully. I was doing other work, and I just fell in love with the orchestral writing. It's really beautiful. And in my brain, I put together this story to match what I was hearing, even though I didn't read the book. I didn't do anything. And then later I went and did a closer listen. And I figured out that I didn't understand what was going on. And so I read the libretto and I went through it. And it seems that this piece doesn't stand on its own. It's embedded in the performance in a very tight way so that it's organically a part of a visual presentation as well. Could you tell us a little bit about the idea behind the piece and what it's about?
Well, the disconnect that you experienced when you first listened to it is intentional, because the basic premise of the work is the experience of being online. So although being online doesn't figure into the work at all times, the idea that this main character who is constantly thrust into various situations is very much like what it's like when we're online.
Right.
So the opera itself is actually a series of vignettes, moments in her experience that lead to the conclusion.
And you're speaking of the main character, the principal?
Yes, principal. Principal is the main character of the opera, and Gabriel, his part in the opera is constantly changing, because in some ways, Gabriel is a manifestation of what Principal is going through and what she's feeling. Gabriel tries to persuade Principal into thinking different things.
Great. Now, I'm going to play a little clip from the opera so that we can hear a little interchange between Principal and Gabriel.
Surprise me,
It's a really interesting clip. You have a character talking with the trumpet. Now explain, Gabriel is the trumpet?
Oh, yes. The entire time. Gabriel has no speaking part whatsoever. And in fact, if it's staged the way it says in the score, which of course, it's as with all opera, it's open to interpretation. But if it's staged the way it's written, Gabriel is behind a scrim and is only revealed in shadow, as are the other two memories as well.
And it really must have presented a technical problem. Did you actually create sentences that the trumpet is speaking?
Surprisingly, it wasn't challenging at all. And this might be the crazy composer, but as I was doing it, I didn't need Gabriel to be saying the words for me to know what Gabriel meant. So as I had these conversations, these one-sided conversations, and I think maybe in some ways the fact that I write music alone had a lot to do with that, this idea that I'm continually having this musical conversation that sometime in the future musicians are going to perform on stage to complete the other side of the conversation. It just seemed very natural to me.
It also involved video projections as well. How did that add to the story?
Well, the video projections have functioned many different ways in the opera. In the interlude and in the overture begins with beautiful sunny days, like memories that are good. She's going to go out and have a good time. The second half of the opera, they are very desolate and winter scenes. So that sort of sets the stage. The rest of the images that play on the scrim are not as defined. The way I look at it is more of colors. I like the idea of representing moods through colors. But I could see how any director that interpreted the work would, you know, have a vast wealth of images that they could play with throughout the opera.
So it sounds like you don't feel as a composer that you need to control the message, that it's open-ended for this opera?
It's intended to be open-ended.
Okay.
You know, I certainly have written works that are very specific message. But in this case, the idea was to craft a work that made us look at ourselves the entire time. The idea is not that everyone is going to be so isolated to be like principal and to give up on interpersonal relationships and things. That's not the purpose of the opera. On the other hand, the genesis of the opera comes specifically from seeing people separate themselves with the use of technology. Mm. Instead of interacting in person, using their cell phones, using phone calls, texting, email, social networking, there are so many ways to do this. And I started to see it replacing interaction. For example, I would see people going out together to do events and not actually talking to each other, but talking to other people on their technology.
It's ironic we're doing this over Skype.
Yes, it is.
So tell me a little bit about the commissioning of this. This was done as part of a trumpet commission?
The Australian Trumpet Guild hosted the 2010 International Trumpet Guild Conference. And the person who runs that, Brian Evans, through him and his vision, this idea of doing something radically different, not only an opera that had an instrument taking the place of a main character, which obviously is not typical.
So this was performed at the conference and in Boston?
The one in Boston was staged, where Principal actually did act out the entire performance.
And in Boston, what kind of reception did it get?
So the reception was good. The audience seemed to really like it. They liked it so much that the opera company that did the performance, Boston Metro Opera, is now going to tour the Northeast and come down to New York City, down your way, as well as make a DVD of their performance. So those are all wonderful things to happen to a new opera.
Great. So listen up, New York, when it's in our area, let's go see it. And Robert, please tell us the next time it's being performed so we can post it on our website. And it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert. Next, I speak with Misha Penton of the Divergence Vocal Theater, and I ask her, what is an opera dance theater work?
Well, the work that I do is very collaborative and multidisciplinary. And I started Divergence Vocal Theater in 2008 as an outlet for my creative vision about opera and multidisciplinary performance that's based on classical vocal music. I often work with dancers or video artists or theater artists. It is this particular piece has a really fantastic dancer who I'm collaborating with in it.
I guess my question would be, what makes it just not an opera? Because opera often has dance, theater.
Right. It is. Opera is the ultimate multidisciplinary form. All of the pieces that I've done actually have spoken text in them. So it, I think of it a little bit more as music theater, not musical theater, but music theater, and not so much strictly what would perhaps typically be thought of as opera.
So in this work, is the sung part of it, how is it integrated into the work? Is it for the action, or how does that work?
It's almost all sung, and then there's text that's interspersed in a very textural way. So it's very musical in terms of the way the text is integrated into the music. So by and large, it is very much an opera. There are three characters in the piece. There's the character that I play. It's based on Clytemnestra, a Greek tragedy heroine. And there's myself singing, a dancer, and an actor. And we all represent sort of aspects of Clytemnestra.
Okay.
In kind of different, through different disciplines and sort of different aspects of her psyche.
Does it cover the whole Clytemnestra story, or?
It covers, it's very expressionistic in terms of sort of the way the piece is put together. It's kind of an emotional landscape of the character. So it has an abstract quality to it. Most of my work does. So it's based on sort of her inner life. She loses her daughter, and ultimately she does murder her husband. But,
of course, it's but, Greek. You know, everyone murders everyone.
Yeah, everybody dies.
it's an opera too.
Exactly. It's required that everyone. And it was actually, this piece was inspired by the University of Houston Honors College. Poet in residence, Dr. John Harvey, creates a new translation of a Greek tragedy every year, and he asked me to perform Clytemnestra in their play. And so that was the idea for this opera project that's kind of a companion to this new translation of the play.
And what is the size of this? Is this a long piece, a short piece, and is there orchestra? How does that work?
It is about 50 minutes. It's scored for soprano, viola, and piano.
And at what point did you know Dominic Diorio before this, and how did you work with him?
I met Dominic through a singer friend of mine, and I have worked with a couple of other composers in the past, Elliot Cole and James D. Norman, and I've written libretti, so this is the second setting of a libretto that I wrote. And I just started talking to Dominic about collaborating, really.
Great. And how did that work? Were you basically in the room together, or was it, here's some text, he wrote music? How did the back and forth go?
He's sort of like this really amazing musician and composer. And I had written the text and I gave it to him, and he sort of sent me scenes, and I sang through them, and we've been collaborating in rehearsal in terms of sort of how the color of the voice is working throughout the piece dramatically. So, but there wasn't this big process of drafts and editing and that kind of thing. It sort of just kind of came together relatively quickly.
Great. It sounds like a great project. I wish it could be in Texas. I'm not the first person to say that.
But. I know. It's a secret, amazing place, Houston.
Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff going on down there. So I want to thank you for agreeing to do this, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, now I'm going to play a little bit of a conversation that I had with Hannah Lash via Skype. This is the first time I've ever had a recorded Skype conversation. It actually came out really well.
Yeah.
I think it came out really well.
I'm going to interject here before we play the interview with Hannah Lash. The piece they are talking about at first is Blood Rose. It's based on the story of Beauty and the Beast. It'll be playing, an excerpt of it will be playing as part of the Vox Festival, Sunday, May 15th at La Poisson Rouge. I'm first going to play a little clip from Blood Rose so you can hear what it sounds like.
A little bit about yourself, Hannah.
Well, let's see. I'm a composer living in New York City and writing for many of the ensembles here, as well as some other places, like, for example, Great Noise Ensemble, a piece for whom I just finished this past week. I am doing an artist diploma at Yale right now, following my PhD at Harvard, and teaching microtonal tunings and advanced electronic music up at Yale, which I'm really, really, really enjoying doing.
Mm. When it comes to your own style of composition, has microtonal writing always been an influence for you?
I wouldn't say necessarily. I mean, I really, honestly, didn't really deal with it in much detail before actually teaching it. A lot of people at Harvard when I was there were quite interested in it. And I think at that point for me, it just wasn't my focus at that point. So, you know, I read about it and thought about it, but never really dabbled in it back then. And then, you know, got this really nice teaching assistantship at Yale and began like really getting into it in much more detail. So now I'm actually planning a whole album length project with microtonality sort of center stage, which for me is kind of a cool way of going about it because I love the idea of delving into something very fully and kind of addressing the argument in a sense, you know, really working out the problem from the what I perceive to be the root of it and following that root as far as I possibly can. So that's sort of what this project is going to be about.
Composers talk often about solving problems.
Yeah.
You know, and it's or rather, you know, even sometimes making problems that they can solve.
Right. Well, I guess as soon as you put your pencil down on the paper, you make a problem.
And but, for you, what's the exciting challenge with writing in that style? Or I mean, would you call it a language, or would you call it a style, or
neither really, but kind of using that palette of colors, maybe to use a slightly outgrown cliche. But how about maybe using that set of tools?
Is Blood Rose entirely microtonal? Is it partially microtonal?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
No, I think in the microtonality, I kind of went off on that tangent because
of that's okay.
fun teaching project I'm doing right now. But Blood Rose doesn't involve microtones. It's really much more of an emotional and harmonic exploration for me of, you know, a folktale that I ended up subverting and looking at in a different way that really resonated with me emotionally.
How much did you change the story?
I was much more interested in sort of what might lie behind the idea of stealing a flower. And I wasn't so interested in the other two sisters, nor was I interested in the father. I was more interested in the act of the theft, what it meant to be a beast in a sense, and the relationship that ensued between Beauty and the Beast. The opera hasn't been staged yet. When it was done in September, it was just with the two singers, Eric Brenner and Kirsten Solik, and the Jack Quartet, and they were all kind of together on the stage, and we didn't do any staging.
Interesting.
But I did envision that, yes, you see him. He doesn't visually look like a beast at all. For me, the idea of being a beast really has more to do with the idea of, you know, becoming emotionally wounded and wanting revenge as a result of the wound.
You wrote your own libretto, which is such an interesting thing.
Yeah, it was. I write a lot of poetry, and I've done this all my life, so I felt very comfortable dealing with this. And the libretto sort of is a long-form poem.
Yeah.
But I don't think I would feel comfortable handling a full-length libretto because I'm not a writer in that sense, but I have written poetry all my life and feel comfortable doing that. And also, I think this was such an internal project for me. It came from such a sort of a deep emotional place that it made sense to me to sort of be that deeply into every single part of the process.
Complete
Yeah. And did you write the libretto entirely before you began the music?
Yeah, I did. And I wanted to make sure to get the form of the libretto just what I wanted it to be before I started. So I ended up, showing it to a lot of people, some of whom were poets, some of whom were actors, some of whom were playwrights, and some of whom were, other composers, just to kind of get a sense of how it bounced off of other people's ears and eyes and hearts. And that was really helpful. And then I wrote the music, kind of following feeling totally comfortable with how the libretto was going. And also the other thing that was tricky was that I was dealing, and I wrote this specifically for these two singers, mm-hmm. partly because, again, I wanted to play with the idea of gender. I didn't want to make the countertenor a truly male identity, nor did I want to make the alto a truly female identity. I wanted it to be much more fluid in that sense. So,
and just to be clear, the countertenor is the beast?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's what I had suspected, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
But you see, I mean, the thing throughout the whole opera is that we see him respond to the violation that he has been the victim of, as that his garden is ravaged, and he wants revenge from Beauty. And as what he does is he cuts her with a thorn and makes her bleed on his garden, thinking that it'll water his plants and make them bloom again. Mm. But as she bleeds, she sort of wants revenge too, and they both sort of, their identities get totally enmeshed.
And let's see, what do you think about, because the only other opera I know that's any, about this, or seems like it's maybe related to this story, is, I was thinking of Bartok's Bluebeard's Castle.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, this is kind of my response to Bluebeard. And I know that, obviously the implications of Bluebeard are, from many people's perspectives, political. And from other people's perspectives, much more gender specific than what I'm dealing with here. But I love the idea of these two characters who are sort of psychologically enmeshed, and they each want something from the other. I mean, although there's no literal drawing on that material, in some ways it is either, sort of a response or an homage on my part to Bluebeard.
Oh, yeah. And that's also a very short work.
Yeah, it is. It is, which was just done last week, I guess.
I know. The funny thing is, I know a lot of Peter's always talking about how the music goes into the public domain very soon. I think maybe next year. So
uh-huh.
it becomes much easier to perform.
Right.
So my last question is, what are your favorite operas? Or is opera something that you naturally are inclined to? Or is it something that you kind of have very specific taste in?
I really love all kinds of opera. I mean, I don't see myself as an opera composer. I just see myself as a composer who also does opera, or whose sort of work output includes opera.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what I love, yes, absolutely, Bluebeard is top of my list, along with Pelléas et Mélisande of Debussy. And then I would say right up there with those two are Ligeti's Le Grand Macabre. Totally different, totally different.
Yeah.
Right now I'm writing an opera of Lolita, and that also is an intense and uncomfortable thing to do, but most of the music is very fast, very lush, and very thick, involving these microcanons and weird moving patterns of accents and polyrhythms that pop up amongst different parts, things like that. So for me, right now Ligeti is more where my mind is going as opposed to Bartok.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like every project kind of calls you to work a different way.
Yeah, I think at this point, I'm sort of seeing my techniques, my toolbox gel a little. So I know that, more or less my go-to things are what they are. But I think that was certainly true for me for a long time.
Well, this has been really fun, Hannah. Thank you so much for talking with us.
That was great.
Yeah, I'm really glad she got a chance to speak with us.
I guess I'll have to go to Vox and
hear
it.
Yeah, you got to go to Vox and see it. And I think that's the, as much as we can spend all day wailing and talking about opera, you got to go see it for yourself, because these works are complicated.
So we want to thank you for listening.
Yeah.
We want you to let us know about audition opportunities that mm-hmm. are coming up that we could help publicize for you. Any interesting projects you've heard about and want us to speak on. I think we should put a place for people to donate on our website, because it would be really great to get a better server I noticed that the download of the podcast is kind of slow.
Yeah.
You know? If someone wants to donate.
If there's any rich benefactors out there sitting around.
I don't care if you're rich. I just want someone who wants to donate.
Okay, so if you're not rich, poor too. Send us your cash. No matter, you know, even if you can't afford it, send it to Indie Opera Podcast.
Especially if you can't afford it.
Especially if you can't afford it. That's right. That's right. Okay.
Well, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
That was an excerpt from Hannah Lash's Furthermore, and we started the podcast with a little excerpt from Robert J. Bradshaw's Dot Gabriel.